afternoon, Juneau. We're just seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. You're also in tune with Juneau Afternoon. We'll have a wonderful lineup of guests this afternoon. We'll be hearing about the UAS Evening at Eagan presentation this evening, about anatomy, medicine, and art along the Italian Peninsula. National Coming Out Day will be discussed. Author John Goodwin will be here to talk about his book, the book Master Mariner, L. Ron Hubbard in Alaska. And Rick Combs will be here to talk about some changes that GCI Internet is putting in downtown that will cause some interruptions in the traffic pattern around town. All that coming up on Juneau Afternoon on a day when we have periods of rain, highs around 45, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. Those will shift over to the southwest later today. And then mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of rain, lows around 37, and southeast winds about 5 miles per hour. So stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A wildfire and heavy rains caused millions of dollars worth of damage recently on the Santa Clara Pueblo in northern New Mexico. After receiving a major disaster declaration by President Obama, the tribe thought they had FEMA funds on the way to help with recovery efforts. But Carrie Young reports that the government shutdown has stalled the process.
Before the Federal Emergency Management Agency could release funding to the tribe, a group of representatives had to visit the Pueblo to assess the damage and determine a final dollar amount. But due to the federal government shutdown, those representatives were not allowed to complete their work and were sent home. Edward Calabaza is the spokesman for the Santa Clara Pueblo. He says the delay is a serious setback and could endanger even more infrastructure on the reservation.
We needed the FEMA aid so that we could start rebuilding roads, building earthen dams, building more catch areas for the water that would hold up. We hope the shutdown is lifted soon because we know it's not only affecting Santa Clara Pueblo, but other tribes and other federal entities as well.
The tribe has already declared its own state of emergency, releasing about $5 million of its own money to fund restoration efforts. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
The biological father of a Cherokee girl known as Baby Veronica dropped his claims of custody yesterday. Kirk Gortney with KGOU has details.
Dustin Brown and an assistant attorney general of the Cherokee Nation said they are dropping ongoing custody cases in both Oklahoma and tribal courts over 4-year-old Veronica. The pair also asked that Matt and Melanie Capo Bianco of South Carolina drop a contempt complaint against Brown. Speaking at a news conference, Brown said his daughter needed a life outside the spotlight.
The time has come for me to let Veronica live a normal childhood that was so desperately needed and deserves.
Last month, Brown gave Veronica to the Capo Biancos after Oklahoma's Supreme Court lifted an order keeping her in the state. This summer, the U.S. Supreme Court said a federal Indian Child Welfare Act law intended to keep Native American children with tribal families did not apply in this case. Fighting back tears, Brown said he wants to remain connected with his daughter.
It is my greatest hope we can work together on a solution that is best for Veronica, one that allows me to continue to be a part of my daughter's life and see and speak with her on a regular basis.
An assistant attorney general for the Cherokee Nation, Chrissy Nemo, said she wants the Capo Biancos to honor their commitment to allow Brown and his family to remain a part of Veronica's life. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
The leader of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe is accusing a mining company of covering up recent findings of asbestos on a proposed mine site. Mike Simonson reports.
In separate revelations this week, the Department of Natural Resources and Northland College geoscience professor Tom Fitz released information that asbestos fibers have been found in an area of the iron ore body in northern Wisconsin. Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says mining company Gagibic Taconite has been hiding that information.
A cover-up of asbestos. Geologists and children could walk in there and see it with the naked eye. Is such a compelling premeditation for disaster, a disaster that would befall the Bad River people and the non-tribal citizens of the Bad River watershed. It's a deal-breaker right there.
But GTAC spokesman Bob Seitz says they're not covering up anything and that Professor Fitz's findings are not credible.
I don't know of any regulator that would make determinations based on a rock that somebody finds. They require much more of us than that.
But Wiggins says GTAC is playing PR with the asbestos findings.
They had the gall to say, as a company, that they're merely recreating a circle of life. Explode an asbestos rock that Tom Fitz has found with the highest levels of asbestos he's ever seen in some of these rocks, and you tell me how that's recreating the circle of life. And I'll say this. It's recreating the circle of life by causing death.
The DNR says they need more information before it can say if the asbestos fibers represent a threat. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
During this month in 1986, the U.S. Congress designated the Nez Perce Historical Trail. The over 1,000-mile trail begins in Oregon and ends in Montana. This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes and 47 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first guest is Dr. Heidi Pearson, who is an assistant professor of marine biology up at the University of Alaska Southeast. But Heidi fell into one of those wonderful things that can happen to an academic with some background in one area and a title in another. Got a vacation or a travel trip to Italy and spent some time looking at the history of anatomy, medicine, and art along the Italian peninsula. And she's going to share that view with us tonight at the UAS Evening at Egan presentation in the campus library. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you, Pat. I'm happy to be here.
Here, let me turn your mic on so the folks at home can hear you. There, that's better. Try that now.
There. Thank you, Pat. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. So, how is it, first of all, that you found yourself on your way to Italy?
Well, I had the fortunate opportunity to travel there with a group from the Human Anatomy and Physiology Society, and I was funded in part by a grant from UAS, from the Office of the Provost. It was an academic innovation award that allowed me to travel to Italy for 12 days.
Now, you teach anatomy at the University of Alaska Southeast.
I do. One of my major course offerings is human anatomy and physiology.
Okay. And so that's the why. Now, the question is, where did you go?
Well, we hit all of the main sites that are included in any general so-called grand tour of Italy, Rome, Florence, and Venice. Mm-hmm. And then we made side trips to Bologna and Padua to visit some other important sites in the study of anatomy.
Now, the organization that you went with, is this a national organization that you're a member of?
The Society is a national professional organization, and this group was a smaller group of interested individuals just in this topic.
And so the organization dreamed up the concept of taking a bunch of people to Italy, this group that was interested in the thing, and the organization sponsored the trip. Kind of.
Well, the leader of the group, Dr. Kevin Petty, is from San Diego Miramar College, and he's the creator and designer of the trip. And there was a group of 20 of us that went. Some of us were members of the professional society. Others were just interested family members and friends.
This is a different kind of tourism than most of us think about. So I understand that it wasn't tourism per se, but it's always a fascinating dimension of going to another country when you take your own interest to it and then see how things are there. Did you get a kind of a double vision?
Yes, and that was the real thrill of doing this trip, was that we went to some of the more famous touristy places, but yet we went to some places that no one else knows about. For example, some of these very exquisite anatomy museums that are hidden away in universities that most people might not even know of.
And so can you give us a description of some of those places that we might never see?
Sure. One of them that stands out is associated with the University of Florence. It's called La Specula Museum. And in this museum, in one of the back sections of it, there are over 500 wax models of human anatomy that were created for the teaching of anatomy before cadavers were readily available and before we had, you know, things like computer simulations and other teaching tools. And so this museum now houses this vast collection of anatomical wax figures.
And were they accurate?
Extremely accurate. And some of the photos I'll show tonight, you'll be able to see the detail that goes into creating all of the muscles and blood vessels and organs.
Now, did you actually look at how that was done? Did you say you got an opportunity to see how the wax was made?
We did not. Oh. So the technique ended about 1930 or so when newer technology became available for teaching, but we did learn about the process by which the models were made.
You also mentioned Michelangelo when we were talking before the mics opened up.
Yes. So we learned a lot about Michelangelo and how he himself was a very astute anatomist and conducted a lot of cadaver dissections himself and then applied his knowledge to paintings such as the Sistine Chapel, where he has hidden pieces of anatomy in his artwork.
Such as?
Such as a great detail of the brain, which is encased in one of the central figures of God surrounded by angels. If you take a close look at it, you see the outline of a brain and some major neuroanatomical features.
Hmm. It's something the average person going to visit the Sistine Chapel probably is unaware of.
That's right.
Were you shocked when it was pointed out to you? Had you known that it was there?
I had done a series of readings leading up to the trip, and so I knew what I would be seeing, but there's nothing like being in the center of the Sistine Chapel and looking up at the ceiling and then seeing it right up there. It was really breathtaking.
Hmm. So in addition to your time spent doing anatomy, medicine, and looking at art along the way, what else did you do while you were in Italy?
We ate and drank a lot.
A memorable meal, perhaps? Can you describe something wonderful that you had?
We did have some excursions that were just fun, and they weren't anatomy-based. So there was a really nice balance to the trip. And as one of our side excursions from Florence, we went to Chianti and toured a winery and then had an amazing lunch of different kinds of cheeses paired with special honeys. We tasted three different kinds of olive oil and about four different kinds of wine.
Well, it sounds like there was not only a great education, the opportunity to hobnob with the rest of the group, and a chance to take in some Italian culture. How much of that will you be able to share with us tonight?
I'll be sharing about all that I learned from the anatomy side of things, and then I intersperse that with some beautiful images of Italy and the culture and the people and the countryside.
Okay. Well, this sounds like a fascinating discussion. What time do you start tonight?
We start at 7 p.m.
7 p.m., and you're in the lecture hall right up at Egan, off the other end of the building from the Egan Library.
Yes, that's correct. Egan Lecture Hall.
Okay, so this is the Evening in Egan presentation. Dr. Heidi Pearson will be talking about Anatomia Italiana, the history of anatomy, medicine, and art along the Italian peninsula. Thank you, Heidi, for coming down and letting us know where we can go tonight for a nice Italian meal.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're not cooking for us, though, I take it.
I am not cooking, but I encourage you to do so afterwards or before.
Okay, good enough. A little Italian music here in my way.
Per terra assai lontana cantano a buor del sonno napolitano. Cantano vetramente ovora poggia scombare a luna mia somare nuovo denaro ma fa. Santa Lucia lontana a te, quanta malinconia, se giro mondo sana, se facere ca fortuna, ma guagne sconta luna, lontana Napoli non se vostra. Lucia totiena, sola un poche mare, e più lontana stai, più bella mare.
pezze chi è nato a Napoli ce può morire. Santa Lucia lontana a te, quanta malinconia, se giro un sana, se facere caporatura, ma quando scompa.
About 15 minutes and a half after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and I have as my next two guests two guys who are here to talk about a rather interesting event that I didn't even know was happening today, but today is evidently National Coming Out Day. With me are Zach Bahachik and Bronze Hickeys, and they're going to tell us about this event. Guys, what's going on?
Well, maybe first it'd be good to talk about the history of Coming Out Day, and Zach was prepared to say a few things about that.
Okay.
So on October 11th in 1987, the second official march onto Washington, D.C. for lesbian and gay rights took place. This brought over 500,000 people across the country just in protest and to spread awareness for the national oppression of the LGBTQ community in that time period. All the activism that followed that year led some advocates to push for an annual day to celebrate the act of coming out and to recognize all of the struggles and the courage that it takes to do so. So on October 11th, 1988, the first National Coming Out Day was celebrated, and it was specifically chosen on October 11th, the year after what became known as the Great March, which was the march onto Washington, D.C., and it sparked a lot of involvement within that community.
So what will happen this year?
So this year in Juneau, today's National Coming Out Day, and we're going to celebrate a function at the university campus Saturday night at 6 p.m., We're going to show a couple of films. We got permission from the studios to show these films for free. There's free admission to go and see these, and they're both about coming out. One is focused with more of a male character, and the other one is a female character. There's two different movies. They're pretty well received. The first one, called White Frog, was released in 2012, and it was a huge hit at the film festivals, gay and lesbian film festivals around the country, and we're going to be showing that. It's a drama comedy aimed at young adults. There's a 15-year-old boy in the story who's kind of a neglected teen, and he has a mild case of Asperger's syndrome, and his life is changed forever when tragedy comes to his family, and it's a story of power of the family, friendship, and love. And it was debuted at the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival in March 2012, and it was very widely received there. And then after that, we're going to have another film called Puccini for Beginners. It's a 2006 American romantic comedy written and directed by Maria Magenti. And the film debuted in the 2006 Sundance Film Festival, and it was pretty popular at the time. It's a comedy, romantic comedy. So those are the movies we're going to show.
So these are at 6 and 8 p.m., and you're holding the screening in the rec center up on the UAS campus.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're collaborating with the Gay Straight Alliance at the university, and the other co-host is the Southeast Alaska Gay and Lesbian Alliance of Juneau.
And these are free admission, open to the public?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And then are there other events for the week or for the day that are scheduled around town?
I'm not aware of any. There's some other things going on, but not specifically related to this topic.
So I guess I'm wondering what kinds of support the LGBTQ community has available to them in Juneau.
Well, certainly Juneau has the Southeast Alaska Gay and Lesbian Alliance, and we have a really wonderful website. You can learn more about that at SEAGLA.org, SEAGLA.org. We even have on there a webpage about coming out. Also in Juneau, we have a PFLAG group, Parents, Friends, Family of Gays and Lesbians. That's an organization here that also supports the local Pride Chorus. You may have heard of them. there's one person from that group who's going to speak before our films, I think. We're hoping to have Sarah Besser there for a few minutes to talk about the March on Washington. I understand that she actually was involved in it in 1980.
Yeah, she was one of the few, if not the only person from Alaska there in attendance of the 1987 march.
Now, last year there was a considerable bit of movement toward same-sex couples being able to get benefits from the state. Where are we standing on that in the state of Alaska at this point?
The benefits actually happened back in 2006, I think it was. And
is it complete at this point, or are there still limitations?
The way it works now is you have to show domestic partner relationship, and there's some discrimination still going on within the state in that if you're a heterosexual married couple, you only need to show your marriage certificate to get benefits from the state. But if you're a gay or lesbian couple and you want to show that you can get benefits, you have to provide 7 or 8 of 9 different source documents to provide that that relationship exists.
Have a significant number of people gone through this arduous process?
My partner and I did that, and back in 2006 when we first won the right to do that. It was painful. A lot of folks struggle with it because even heterosexual couples sometimes cannot produce those documents because they don't necessarily have all of those legal things in place, but all they have to show is a marriage certificate. So we kind of see that as a discriminatory against us because we're having to provide additional documentation to prove that we have a relationship, and it seems unfair.
What's the status of same-sex marriage in Alaska?
Well, the Constitution forbids it. That was something that passed several years ago now. I can't remember the exact. I think it might have been 2002. So it's currently defined. Marriage is defined between one man and one woman in Alaska. There isn't anything going to be changing that in the near future. The last time that came up for conversation at the legislature, just this last year, I think the people who were in office talking about it were caught laughing about how funny that was and that they would never see that come for them as far as an issue to be reviewed. So I don't know, you know, politically I think it's not going to be changing in the near future, but certainly the ACLU of Alaska is working on the issue. There are things underway.
And I guess the other question is, in general, do you have a read for what the level of discrimination is in Alaska? Are we an extremely discriminatory state?
I think it varies from community to community. I think it varies for different people. I don't think it's, you know, the same for everyone. I feel like, for me personally, Juneau is very live and let live kind of town. I think Juneau is a very open and accepting place to live. I really like it here. But I also think Juneau might be a little bit of a liberal enclave in Alaska. I think if you live in Wrangell or Petersburg or Haines or some of these other communities, it might not be quite as easy for somebody who is got a gay or lesbian or sexual orientation or a transgendered person. Zach is actually from Anchorage. He might be able to speak to what it's like in Anchorage.
Go ahead, Zach.
Well, I haven't really experienced any myself in Anchorage. I know that you get the occasional words from folks, but overall it's generally people are willing to accept it overall, I feel.
And I notice UAS is hosting the events, and the Gay-Straight Alliance up on UAS is fairly active up there. Is the campus overall a pretty accepting place?
I'm not a current student.
The campus is quite accepting, actually. The GSA there does have a very active presence, and people are well aware of its existence. They're well aware of any of the other programs that are put on by the GSA.
Mm-hmm.
So the student body is very accepting and tolerant.
So this is National Coming Out Day. Is there advice available? You mentioned a website that people can go to.
I mentioned the Sigla website, but also I wanted to give a different URL that has something. And where did I put that one? It was www.hrc.org/campaign/coming-out-center. And they actually have a whole website with all kinds of information about whether you're just questioning or how to do it or examples of people who have done it. In fact, right now they have a YouTube video up there that I just saw this morning that is absolutely amazing, that has, it's about 3 minutes long, and it has all kinds of snippets of very famous people who have come out recently in the last few years, and movie stars and actors and singers and athletes, and it's a very, very well done 2 or 3 minute video that they have posted up there right now. So it's encouraging for young people.
That was such a massive length of URL. Can you do it one more time? But I'm thinking it probably, if you just Google
National Coming Out
Day. National Coming Out Day, it'll probably get you to something real close to it.
HRC.org will get
HRC.
You there.
Okay. HRC.
And Coming Out is one of the main links they'll have on the front page.
Okay. Okay. So someone who's contemplating making a bold move today or tomorrow might be able to get a little moral support.
Or just want to explore what, you know, other people have gone through. There's a lot of coming out stories available there. And then on the CEGLA.org site, we have posted some selected YouTube videos that we've chosen that are about coming out. So people's different struggles with it. So it's certainly worth checking out if you were interested.
What a world it would be if we didn't have to struggle, wouldn't it?
One of the things I wanted to say also was that the GSA is going to be doing a bake sale at this movie night.
Oh, okay.
To raise some money for their club. They're going to have some brownies and some muffins and fresh popcorn, and I think they're even going to make some grilled sausages or something. So.
Okay, so the films are White Frog at 6 o'clock and Puccini for Beginners at 8 o'clock. They're both at the UAS Student Rec Center on Saturday night. The event will last until 10 o'clock. Concessions are being sold by the USA Gay Straight Alliance, and these two films are free and open to the public.
That's correct.
And I guess thank you very much for coming out and telling us about coming out.
Well, thank you very much for having us here. We've really appreciated it.
You bet.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 11th of October, 2013. It's the birthday of the man who founded the YMCA, Sir George Williams, born on a farm in Somerset, England, 1821. On this day, went off to London, got a job in a draper's shop. It was a sweatshop. He became a devoted Christian, wanted his fellow laborers to have some place they could congregate outside of work and a place where they wouldn't be led into the temptations of drink, a place they could go to develop a, quote, healthy spirit, mind, and body. Today it has 45 million members around the world. It's the birthday of Eleanor Roosevelt, born in New York City, 1884, who was first lady longer than any other, and who, during her husband's presidency, campaigned hard on the issue of civil rights, which was not so popular back in the 30s. And the 40s. Eleanor Roosevelt, who said, "You wouldn't worry so much about what others think of you if you realized how seldom they do." It's the birthday of a physicist, Lewis Fry Richardson, born Northumberland, England, 1881, the first to apply mathematical techniques to predict the weather accurately. Wrote a book about it in 1922, Weather Prediction by Numerical Process. The problem with the theory was that it took him about 3 months to predict the weather for the next 24 hours. It had to wait until the advent of the computer to work. It was on this day, 1962, Pope John XXIII convened the first session of the Second Vatican Council, Vatican II. As a result of which, Catholics were allowed to pray with Protestants and go to weddings and funerals in Protestant churches. Priests were encouraged to perform Mass facing the congregation, and priests were allowed to perform Mass in languages other than Latin. It's the birthday of the novelist Elmore Leonard, New Orleans, 1925, started out writing westerns in the early 50s. His first novel, The Bounty Hunters, came out in 1953. Then, when the market for westerns seemed to be drying up, he set out to write crime novels. The first, The Big Bounce. Came out in 1969 after it was rejected by 84 different publishers. Almost all of his books since then, including 52 Pickup, Get Shorty, Out of Sight, and most recently Djibouti, have been bestsellers. It's the birthday of François Mauriac, born in Bordeaux, France, 1885. Most of his novels set in Bordeaux became famous for his book A Kiss for the Leper. François Mauriac, who said, "I believe that only poetry counts. A great novelist is, first of all, a great poet." Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, the poetry teacher. The university gave me a new, elegant classroom to teach in. Only one thing, they said, you can't bring your dog. It's in my contract, I said. I had made sure of that. We bargained, and I moved to an old classroom in an old building, propped the door open, kept a bowl of water in the room. I could hear Ben, among other voices, barking, howling in the distance. Then they would all arrive, Ben, his pals, maybe an unknown dog or two, all of them thirsty and happy. They drank, they flung themselves down among the students loved it. They all wrote thirsty, happy poems. Mary Oliver's poem, The Poetry Teacher, from her collection Dog Songs, published by Penguin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Support for this program comes from Balloons by Night Moods, providing Juneau with new, used, and consigned party goods. Balloons by Night Moods, located at 9342 Glacier Highway in the Valley. More info at 523-1099.
Now I'm covered.
Now we're covered.
Now for the first time, you can be covered with a quality health plan from the new Health Insurance Marketplace, part of the healthcare law. It's where brand name companies offer plans you can compare side by side, and it's the only place to get lower monthly payments. So if you have an accident, get sick, or just need a checkup, I'm covered. Enroll now at the Health Insurance Marketplace at healthcare.gov. Sponsored by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in cooperation with your State Broadcasters Association and this station.
It's 27 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is coming to us from far away. John Goodwin is the head of the publishing company called Galaxy Press, which is publishing a number of books by L. Ron Hubbard. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So, John, there's a book out which is being circulated around called L. Ron Hubbard in Alaska, Master Mariner, which talks about some of Hubbard's voyages to Alaska and other places around the world as a master mariner.
Yes, it was a. It's really interesting, this story with Alaska specifically, because that was his first. That's where he first earned his Master Mariner license, on that journey to Alaska, where he went from Puget Sound in Washington and sailed all the way up to Ketchikan. And it was done as under the auspices of the Explorers Club, as well as under the U.S. Navy. And what he was doing was charting the coastal waters there, because the pilot was very inaccurate, and there were a lot of problems with vessels hitting reefs. And there was, I think, one whirlpool that various ships would get lost in. And so he did a whole thing there to experiment with a device that later became known as the LORAN, long-range navigational. He did one of the first things that he was piloting for the U.S. Navy. But it was on that trip, though, that he, like I said, he basically sailed and earned his Master Mariner's license. And it was actually quite amazing when he gets up into Alaska, where he talks about the waters and how treacherous they were. And the book itself is quite amazing, Master Mariner at the Helm Across Seven Seas.
So when did Hubbard make those voyages? It's in the 1950s, is that right?
Well, that was actually August 30th, 1940, when he actually arrived in Alaska.
So, and he was using radio direction finding at this point,
right,
by taking basically headings off of the broadcast stations that were operating in Alaska and using them to locate various objects that he was trying to put on the maps.
That's right. And when he actually, when he got there, he also, there was a station in Ketchikan called KGBU that he started, while he was there, he started a show where he actually broadcast and talked about various mariner topics that enabled the listeners to get more of what he learned, having navigated so much, because he spent quite a time actually in the sea. So it was, he became very popular as a local, basically voice, working with a guy in by the name of Jimmy Britton, who's there, the voice of Radio Alaska.
Yeah, he and Britton put together a show which was kind of a question and answer thing with a reader's or a listener's question, and then they would respond to it and talk about the various aspects of well, one of them, I think, was on sale, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yeah. There's one little section in his journal that I'd like to read, if I could, please, because it's really descriptive of what it was like coming in there. And I've talked to somebody else before from the air, and he said that is, it's so like what it is still.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, good. So this is on August 30th of 1940. Thursday was one long chain of appeasement to the hunger of the sea. First, the jib sheet slipped from the rail and went into the wheel there to stick so solidly that no amount of chopping would free it. We were in the middle of Chatham, as it happened, with a large sea running. I had no liking for hanging on desperately, seas running green over my face, and when I had tried three times and come up soaking and so exhausted as to have difficulty in getting back aboard, I quit. We had the main up, and so, cracking on the jib, said it was sail or nothing, and northward ho. We gradually found a steady wind, fair, and got along at about 5 knots despite the sea. We said we would anchor at the north end of Dundas Island, but we didn't dare, for that was a lee with the sea running. At dusk, we had to pass up at Nacket Bay at the side of Dixon Entrance, for it was too many miles in the lee to be run with the sea, and that was rolling there. And so with a long Pacific swell, heightened by wind on our beam and a cross swell from Chatham, wind-driven, and a tide running obliquely to both, we fought our way into the night and U.S. waters again. We took a bad shaking up for bilge water, climbed on in the tossing over the floorboards, making the cabin deck a minor sea in itself. Not a thing on the ship, it seemed dry or in place. But the wind blew on, and the darkness was gray with rain, and the tiny bits of light, which were our only guides, would vanish for minutes at a time in the downpour and blackness, leaving us without any idea of direction, for the wind was caroming off headlands, and the tidal currents were uncertain, and the reefs were many. Without doubt, Neptune was getting even with us. He snatched away my cap and let it float until I almost swamped this coming about, and was in the act of reaching for it when it sank lazily out of sight. With a shattering snarl, our whisker pole flew into fragments and over the side. A belaying pin went by the boards. Hour in and hour out, we lost things and could do nothing about it but weep. All in the ink, save for occasional glimpses of wholly unfamiliar lights, worn out from hours at the helm with the sea banging it about, we won through the night, 90 miles under sail, through heavy seas and ink, the dawn grayed, showing us the tortuous courses of our channel. The rain was coming down with renewed violence, but Ketchikan was in sight. We were ghosting along in the calm waters of the Narrows with the tide with us for a change. I anchored and lashed up. The town, despite rain, was awake. Ketchikan, we have won. We arrived in Alaska, and maybe tomorrow we will even go ashore. So that was his end.
Sounds like a typical voyage.
Yeah, so it was quite a deal, but it was, he received, like I said, he received his Master Mariners from this trip, and it was, he's various letters of thanks, because they didn't have the current charts that were actually valuable that would help people, plus what he did on researching this new navigational equipment.
Hubbard started out his writing career writing for Astounding magazine, science fiction magazine, and magazines like that in the pulp fiction era. And
right.
I think you're also publishing some of his, republishing some of his early pulp fiction, including a rather interesting specimen of Alaskan writing called The Chee Chalker.
Exactly. The newcomer, right.
Yeah, the term is actually Chichaco. I noticed that he slid the vowels a little bit in some places, but Chichaco
yeah.
is a newcomer to Alaska. Anyway, this was kind of a wonderful, I'm not sure if you'd call it a totally noir novel, but it was very, very 1930s, 1940s detective style, and quite entertaining too. It was had the usual number of necessary fist fights and so forth, but
yeah.
Norton, the key character in the thing, can handle himself pretty well, and it makes for
a fine old
yarn. When was that actually published? Do you know?
It was published in 1947. It was written in 1940, but it was published in 1947, and he had a war in the middle, which he was a lieutenant in the Navy, so that kind of like put a halt on a lot of stuff back then, but it got published after he returned from the war. But it's interesting how he used a lot of the, you know, the terminology that, you know, some of the words are like, where'd this word come from? And you find out that it was something that he picked up from, you know, local dialect from the area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, he started off writing his, I guess, 21 or so is when he came out with his first published pulp fiction story. And throughout the course of the 30s and 40s, he published some almost 200 different stories. He used his own and 15 different pen names because he was so prolific that he was able to, sometimes there'll be two or three stories in a single issue of a magazine under different names.
Yeah, I understand that was a fairly common technique during the time to manage to get more than one submission published, because they were paying by the word, and it was not a lot that they paid per word. So
yeah, penny a word. So
yeah, if you were living off of it, you wanted to get as much column inches as you could into
That's
the
right.
magazine in the day. Anyway, some of these are good, still great, rousing yarns and great fun to read. This one in particular, and someone has done, I don't know who the artists are on it, but there's a very excellent 2-CD version of this book as well. It's very well narrated and has a great 30s feel to it as you listen to it.
Yeah, what we did was we took these and we tried to replicate them from the look and feel of a pulp fiction book. By the definition of pulp, it was a type of paper that was printed. It was pulpwood paper, so it was very coarse. It was an acid base, so that's why it's like newspaper, you know, how after it's been out for, exposed to the sun for like a day, it gets all yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pulpwood paper. So, and it was, that was what it was printed on, but this was before the days of television, and so it was radio, and there were radio dramas. So like I'm sure you've heard like The Lone Ranger and those types of things, which are broadcast over the air, and that's what we're trying to create that, but instead of, and maybe you've heard them recently, they're very hard to hear and very scratchy, and the sound effects back then used to be done with something called a Foley board, and that's a little tray that somebody, an operator, have with sand in it, and so if you hear somebody walking or scuffing, they take the shoes and scuff it along on the sand there, and they'd have different devices that they would use to make sounds with that would simulate what it would be like that they're saying in the story. What we have about 75,000 sound effects. Anything that we didn't have, we'd create. And the other thing we'd do, too, is we'd get the exact sound. So if a certain type of a gun goes off or a certain type of an engine from a ship or an airplane that describes, it is that sound that you hear. So we went through a lot of effort to make sure that when you're listening to one of our stories done in this old radio drama format, that it pulls you into it because you're hearing those exactly right sounds. And so a lot of people, when we have our theater, are able to just feel like, wow, I was right there. It just pulled me right into it. And that's what you're able to do if you have the correct sound and the right words.
Well, they're very well produced, and I certainly congratulate you on the job that you did with Chee Chalker. I'm hoping maybe there'll be some more of these. So the book that's out right now is L. Ron Hubbard, Master Mariner, and talks about his Alaskan adventures in addition to the rest of his career at sea. And then the other one we've been talking about is the Chee Chalker, which is available as a 2-CD set or as a book, both from, I guess, Galaxy Press. I don't know if
Correct.
They're for sale in Juneau or not. I'm not sure that there are any stores here.
Well, definitely if you have any Barnes and Nobles up there.
In Juneau. It's okay. Two independent bookstores, yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure about them, but I do definitely know that on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, you can get them. And the other thing we're working at doing, too, and that's something that we're in the middle of planning, is I work a lot with Boy Scouts, and this is the idea to encourage reading, because these stories, what makes them really special is that they're high interest, high adventure, but they're actually, in the stories, there isn't any sex, and the profanity is kept to the heck, you know. It's not, there's the storytelling at it doesn't have the heavy profanity, which makes it inappropriate for middle school. So we do a lot with middle school and high school students, as well as we have a lot of military that love these stories, as well as truckers who listen to more of these audiobooks than you can shake a stick at. But in doing this, what I'm working on doing is putting together a project to go up to Alaska, where I'd probably want to go to both Ketchikan as well as Juneau, because I think you're the closest city to Ketchikan from what I could see looking at the map.
Yes.
And to work out bringing some Hollywood actors up there to do a program in both cities, and wanted to do the Tree Chalker performance with the actual Hollywood actors that recorded it, and we get somebody from local to help on it as well, and open it up and invite the local townsfolk to attend the show and get some experience about, like, this is what radio theater is like. And I'm doing something, I said, working with the Boy Scouts to be able to make it a thing to help encourage the reading merit badge.
John, sounds like a great project. We'll look forward to maybe hearing some more about it.
I look forward to being able to tell you some more about
it. Okay, good. John Goodman, who is the president of Galaxy Press, publishers of L. Ron Hubbard, Master Mariner, and The Cheech Hawker. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Bird Note. Remember this sound from your childhood? It's one of our most familiar wild sounds, the calls of Canada geese flying high overhead in long, gangly V formation. And it's one of our most enduring emblems of the change of seasons. October is the peak month in the southward migration of Canada geese, geese that bred in summer in Canada and Alaska. But, you ask, aren't there Canada geese around all through the year on park lawns and golf courses? Where do these geese fit into the picture? It's complicated. The birds we think of as Canada geese, brown geese with a white chin strap marking, actually comprise a whole range of geographic populations. Some are larger, some smaller, and most subgroups have distinct breeding ranges north of the U.S. border. However, some Canada geese are now largely non-migratory, much to the chagrin of golfers and others. Many of the geese that now stay year-round are the descendants of birds introduced by game management authorities in an effort to revive some of the original wild populations that had been decimated by the 1900s. So, while some Canada geese are migratory, flying thousands of miles each year between nesting and wintering sites, others are happy to stick around. We humans have made them an offer they can't refuse. Acres and acres of delectable grass on lawns, parks, and golf courses. There's a lot more to learn on our website, birdnote.org.
It's just about 12 minutes or 11 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Just updated the weather forecast here, and it's basically saying that tonight we'll have numerous rain showers. Lows around 41, southeast winds 10 miles per hour, becoming light later, and then Saturday mostly cloudy with scattered showers. Saturday night, cloudy. Sunday with rain, highs around 49, and then Sunday night, rain heavy at times with lows around 41. On Columbus Day, we're looking at heavy rain at times, and then on Monday night, rain likely. Chance of rain on Tuesday, mostly cloudy on Tuesday night and Wednesday, and then Wednesday into Thursday, mostly cloudy. So the rain's probably going to let up first part of next week. Anyway, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is here to tell us about some increases in bandwidth. Always a wonderful thing to hear about. Rick Cummins is here from GCI. And Rick, you're doing some upgrading on the system, right?
That's correct. GCI, we've launched a major construction project here in Juneau. We're going to increase our cable plant from 500 megahertz to 870 megahertz. We're invested several million dollars to add additional capacity to our existing infrastructure so that we can provide more services, more HD channels, and higher internet speeds.
Okay, so the system as it exists right now gives us what speed for, say, internet operations?
Right now we're
operations.
At like 22 megs.
22 megabytes yeah. of data per second, is that?
Yeah.
Okay. And so what's going to happen after all of this new, after you dig up all of the ground and stick in the new wire and all that sort of new cable?
Well, the main thing is it's going to allow us to go to DOCSIS 3. Currently, we're at DOCSIS 2.
I have no idea what that meant.
That is the platform on how the cable modems work.
Okay.
And so with that increase, with the change in that platform, that's going to bump our speeds up to about 50 megs.
Okay, and so this will primarily give us more internet speed, but then we also get more HD TV channels, is that correct?
Yeah. That's correct.
Okay.
We have more cable programming, HD channels, standard F channels. Yes.
Rick, what's the penetration? How many houses have you got wired up in Juneau?
We've got about 10,000.
Okay, so roughly, is that what, a third, two-thirds, three-thirds? How much of the percentage of households?
I think Juneau is about 30,000, so.
Yeah, 30,000 people, but I don't know the household count.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you think you got 10,000
yeah.
online. Now, that 10,000, when, I guess what I'm talking about is how the effect of that with you do it in clusters, right?
Correct, nodes.
So are the nodes going to get smaller as a result of this?
That's correct.
Okay, and what's the effect of that for a GCI subscriber? What are they
going
to see?
Well, as far as cable TV goes, you're not going to see any difference in
what
that.
What about internet?
Other than that, but internet, that's going to make great gains in that because we've got a couple of nodes that are extremely crowded right now that we need to get broken up and broken in half or broken into three different nodes.
So, Rick, if I'm on a crowded node, what does that do to me?
If you've got everybody, like, say, on a weekend and everybody's home and they're out on the internet surfing, gaming, that's going to slow you down. And
So my upload and down, my download speed slows down. It takes longer for things to appear on my screen and so
correct.
Okay. And so when you break the nodes up, then basically what that means is fewer subscribers are sharing a node.
Correct.
Okay. Is there some optimal number? Are you trying to hit a...
We're trying to get at least, I think it's like 200 houses or customers per node.
Okay. And if there are 200 customers per node and they're all surfing the internet and like that, is there visible slowing at 200?
Usually at that amount of folks, it's not because you're not going to get all 200 on at the same time. There'll be breaks in the amount of folks that are surfing. I mean, you got your folks that are downloading movies. They're gaming, and then you got your regular folks that are just checking their
email.
Internet or getting online to pay their bills or whatnot.
Right.
So,
okay. So, when will it be better?
Okay. So this is like about a 2-year project. We just started this week on the upgrade, which we started downtown. We wanted to take advantage of the cruise ship end of the cruise ship season and before the legislative session kicked in. We're looking at completing this next summer.
Next summer, okay.
Summer
and so in between now and then, are there going to be times when I will turn on my computer and I won't have access?
Well, what we're going to the game plan is to do this during our maintenance windows, which is between midnight and 6 a.m.
Okay.
So
unless you're a late-night user.
Right.
Right.
The folks that do the stock market may see the... the most. That's probably where we might get some complaints.
Yeah, okay.
If we happen to be in their neighborhood.
So I guess the other you sell this stuff. I don't know, maybe this is for a marketing person rather than the work that you do, but you sell the GCI product in packages. In other words, people buy internet coverage, they buy television, and they buy their telephone, possibly all in one kind of bundle.
And their wireless cell phone.
Yeah. So is it is the day coming when those bundles are more flexible than they have been in the past? I guess is the question I'm asking. It's been kind of like you have to take this set. And you can't do a lot of picking and choosing.
That would be for marketing. I mean, primarily, my job, I supervise the techs
right. Come
in your house. But I am sure that things will be coming where things will get a little more flexible.
Okay. And then I guess this is a question then for the tech, and that is if I'm a GCI subscriber and I'm having trouble with something on my system, what are my options? What do I need to do in order to get it straightened out? Because I'm sure you want it straightened out as much as I do.
Of course I do. You can call the 800 number, talk with our ITS folks up in Anchorage. There's some things that they can walk you through. It may just be a minor glitch that you could fix, or you could come in to one of the stores, the downtown store or the Valley store, if it's a bad box or a bad modem, and swap that out yourself if you don't have the time to wait for the guy for my text. Or you can just set up a trouble call, and we'll come out and do our best to get everything fixed.
Is there a simple way, if I'm an internet user on GCI, is there a simple way for me to kind of gauge my download speed and see what I'm getting, make sure that I'm getting what I'm paying for?
There's a speed test out there, GCI, I think it's on the GCI.net website, has a speed test.
Okay.
You can,
so if I run that, it'll tell me that I'm what I should have and what I'm actually getting. So that'd be the first indication that there's a problem that I need to maybe have somebody take a look at.
Correct.
So 2 years of upgrading, and at the end of that time, and as we go along, I guess neighborhoods get better. Then within a couple of years, we'll be much closer to this 200 optimum per node number.
Oh yeah.
And along the way, we get more HDTV and we get more. More internet speed.
Right. I'm sure as soon as we get the whole upgrade done, then we'll start turning things up.
So. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for filling us in on the status of the construction project and kind of warning us that we may have a day here when things get a little rocky, but then after that it'll all look better.
I do have a number. If you're one of that, we'll be putting signs up in the neighborhoods that we're working. If you do have issues, you can call the 1-800-800-4800 number.
1-800-800-4800. Okay, good enough. Thank you. Thanks, Rick. Russian music in herald of the upcoming symphony concert here in Juneau that will be an all-Russian program. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI cable on digital channel 871, and we're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much, listeners like you. Tune in again for Juno Afternoon on Monday. Joan Pardis will be your host. She'll be talking to the Juno Roller Girls about their new season. Carla Hart and Ben Lyman will show up to talk about Auk Bay planning. Lisa Ronczak will be here with a preview of her presentation, Understanding Adult Guardianship, scheduled for Monday night. And photographer Chris Miller will be showing photographs of the Taku River Wednesday at the Silver Bow. And so she'll be talking with Chris about his show. Pat Morbin, your host today for Juno Afternoon. Thank you very much for tuning in. It's been a great joy to bring you these folks, and we'll see you again next Friday. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.